since April of 1985. This is the DX Audio Service. National
Radio Club. Welcome to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service for January 2014. This is issue number 348, and I'm your host, Fred Volbe. The address for the DX Audio Service is 706 McKenzie Drive, Lima, Ohio, 45805. The email address for general inquiries should be sent to fvobe, that's F-V-O-B-B-E, at realoldiesradio.com. My telephone number for short calls is 419-228-6223. That number is not to be used for musings or to leave reports for the DX Audio Service. The musings line is 419-741-0205. A yearly subscription to the DX Audio Service for U.S.-Canadian members is now $30, and the magazine is published on CDs. To subscribe or renew, make your check payable to the National Radio Club Incorporated and send them to me at the address that I just mentioned, or log on to our website at www.nrcdxas.org and sign up using PayPal. If you're on the internet, you can sign up to EDXN and get your DX Audio Service in MP3 format. A subscription to EDXN is only $15. Just point your browser to www.e-dxn.com and subscribe online with PayPal. But subscribe only if you're able to download and navigate a website without anyone else's assistance. Now here's Wally Walrow from Dallas, Texas.
How would you like to win a new 2014 WRTH for $12 for USA members?
Sorry, the cost to Canada is more than the cost of the book.
The NRC has four copies that will be available to members. To receive a chance at the drawing, just send a postcard or letter to NRC WRTH Drawing, Post Office Box 473251, Aurora, Colorado 80047-3251. We'll draw four names of National Radio Club members in good standing. Your subscription to DX News, DX Audio Service, or EDXN.com must be current. And notify the winner by phone, provided you supply your phone number. The four lucky winners will receive the WRTH,
no, not the former 590 in Illinois,
after they send us $12 shipping and handling,
and a buck or two for the NRC Treasury.
Deadline for your response in the P.O. Box will be Saturday, February 15th. That address again is NRC WRTH Drawing, Post Office Box 473251, Aurora, Colorado 80047-3251.
This is the AM Switch. To contribute to the AM Switch, send any local observations of call letter changes, changes in operations, or other information to Fred Volbe. You're listening to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service.
Happy New Year and welcome to the January edition of AM Switch. We have three editions of the Switch, starting off with volume 81, number 9, call letter changes, 1020 KOAN, Eagle River, Alaska, changes calls to KVNT, 1050 KKRX, Lawton, Oklahoma, is now KXCA, 1120 WZBR, Coral Springs, Florida, a new CP not yet on the air, changes their call sign to WMSX. 1080 WCRI, Hope Valley, Rhode Island, becomes WSKP. 1230 WBEV, Beaver, Oregon, has a call change for this new CP not yet on the air. It will be KRAM. 1270 WRJM, Charleston, Illinois, changes back after less than 2 years to WEIC. 1340 WELG, Mountain Home, Georgia, has a call change to WHTD, which signals that this silent station may be coming back on the air. 1380 KXCA, Lawton, Oklahoma, changes its call to KKRX. 1400 KRAM, Vernal, Utah, has a call change. New CP not yet on the air. It'll be KBEV now. 1410 WMSX Brockton, Massachusetts, changes its call sign to WZBR. It had been silent and has a construction permit to move to Dedham, Massachusetts. Now let's look at applications for CPs. 1310 WTLB Utica, New York, applies for U1, 2600 watts day and 38 at night, decreasing power. 1480 WEEO, Shippensburg, Pennsylvania. Applies for U1, 410 watts day, 9 watts at night from a new antenna at their existing site. 1510 WJKN, Jackson, Michigan. Applies for D1, 380 watts. They have a license for D3, 5 kilowatts, but they've had a longstanding STA for micropower out of a temporary antenna from a new site. 1530 WVBF, Middleborough Center, Massachusetts, applies for U4, 5,000 watts day and 4 watts night. They are now U1, 2,200 watts day and 2 watts night, and they're moving to the former WPEP 1570 towers. Construction permits granted. 810 WJJQ, Tomahawk, Wisconsin, granted a CP for U1, 940 watts day and 12 watts at night, increasing tower height. 920 KIHM, Reno, Nevada, granted a CP to U2, 4,800 watts day and 850 night from a new site, raising up the day power. 960 CKNT, Mississauga, Ontario, has their CP for a new station operating U4, 2,000 watts day, 280 watts night, extended to November 22, 2015. 990 CHRF, Montreal, Quebec, their CP for a new station U4, 50 kilowatts day and night, has been extended to November 21, 2014. 1120 WNWF, Destin, Florida, granted CP for U1, 3,000 watts day, 12 watts at night, and critical hours power of 2,400 watts, moving to 1140. 1150 WSNW, Seneca, South Carolina's CP was granted to U1, 5,000 watts day, 58 watts night. Their old day power was 1 kilowatt. 1190 WCRW, Leesburg, Virginia, granted CP for U4, 50,000 watts day, 1,000 watts night. They become a dual-site operation. Their present site will be the day transmitter. 1230 KSGG, Reno, Nevada, is granted U1, 1,000 watts day and night from a new site. 1340 KRMD, Shreveport, Louisiana, drops power from a kilowatt day and night to U1, 400 watts day and night. 1460 WEEN, Lafayette, Louisiana's CP for U1, 1100 watts day, 119 watts night, is on the air after raising the daytime power. 1530 KQSP, Shakopee, Minnesota, granted D4, 24,000 watts day with critical hours power of 17,000 watts. They were U4, 8,600 watts day, 10 watts night. And 1600 WTZQ, Hendersonville, North Carolina, granted U1, 5,000 watts day, 30 watts night, doubling their power. Construction permits deleted. 670 KMZQ, Las Vegas, Nevada, the CP for U4, 25,000 watts day, 600 watts night, expired. The station has applied for a new CP to replace it. 1550 WZRK, Lake Geneva, Wisconsin's CP for moving to Northbrook, Illinois, with D1, 1,500 watts, has expired. So WZRK will remain in Lake Geneva. Applications for construction permits dismissed. 1390 WBLL, The Bell, in Bellefontaine, Ohio's application for a move to Grandview Heights, Ohio, dismissed. That move, if it would happen, would take the station into the eastern suburbs of Columbus. Construction permit completed and moving toward licensing. 1330 KTON, Cameron, Texas. They've been granted program test authority for a CP to upgrade to U4, 2,400 watts daytime, 130 watts at night. CP now on the air, 1260 WWRC, Washington, D.C., on the air with their new U4, 35,000 watts day and 5 kilowatts night. Quick look at stations just off the air. 580 CKUA, Edmonton, Alberta, went silent November 21st on the station's 86th anniversary, remaining only on FM and the Internet. 600 KERB, Kermit, Texas, the license was turned in by the licensee. Calls and facility deleted. 910 WMRB, Columbia, Tennessee, has been silent since July 1st. They have financial problems and are seeking a buyer. 1020 WSBX, Ochlockney, Georgia, didn't respond to FCC inquiries as to their operating status, so the license is canceled and the calls deleted as of November 22nd. 1050 WPQR, Conway, New Hampshire. The license was also turned in by the licensee and the calls deleted. 1180 KRL, Honolulu, Hawaii, had returned from silence on October 5th and now needs a new combiner, so they went silent again on October 7th. 1260 WTJH, East Point, Georgia, is silent during a pending sale. 1430 KCRX, Roswell, New Mexico. This station had been deleted for failure to file license renewal and has now filed for a late renewal application, but so far remains silent. 1440 KPTO, Pocatello, Idaho, silent as of November 23rd, awaiting new owners. 1470 KUOL, San Marcos, Texas. The license was turned in by the licensee. Call letters deleted. 1530 KCLR, Rawls, Texas. The license turned in. Calls deleted. 1590 WIJK, Ocean City, Maryland. Went silent November 18th for financial reasons. And 1660 KXOL, Bingham City, Utah. Silent November 20th to investigate problems of signal interference. Stations back on the air, three co-owned Texas stations, KELG 1440 Manor, Texas, KTXZ 1560 West Lake Hills, Texas, and KOKE 1600 Pflugersville, Texas, had their licenses canceled and call signs deleted on August 1st for failing to file renewal applications. The licensee filed late renewal applications on August 8th, an application to broadcast with STAs on August 12th, and a petition to reinstate the licenses and call signs on August 28th. On November 18th, the FCC granted the August 28th petitions and reinstated the licenses, but fined the stations a total of $18,000 for the late renewal filings and for operating without authorization between August 1st and 12th. 620 KHNU, Hilo, Hawaii, returned to the air November 18th after a year's silence. 1260 WTJH, East Point, Georgia, has been silent since December 2nd, 2012. They returned to the air on November 6th with U1, 100 watts day and 39 watts night. 1340 KOLE, Port Arthur, Texas, resumed operations October 18th. They'd been off since July. 1410 WZBR, Dedham, Massachusetts, had been silent since October 15th. As WMSX Brockton, they resumed operations with the Dedham CP on November 26th. 1420 WRSA, St. Albans, Vermont, resumed operations on October 1st after being off the air for 6 months. 1490 WFAD, Middlebury, Vermont, resumed operations on October 2nd after being off for 7 months. Special Temporary Authority is our next subject. 590 WKZO Kalamazoo, Michigan, has been granted an STA for U2 5,000 watts day, 1,250 watts night, due to a tower damaged in a tornado, presumably on Sunday, November 17th. 620 KHNU Hilo, Hawaii, has been granted an STA for U1 500 watts day and night from an emergency long wire antenna. It seems they lost their transmitter site. Okay, Phil Wayne, what did you do with it? 1050 WMSG Oakland, Maryland, has been granted an STA to reduce power, currently operating at U1 65 watts day and night due to lightning damage to transmitter. 1130 KWKH Shreveport, Louisiana, granted STA to operate with parameters at variance until night pattern is relicensed. The application is to extend U1 50 kilowatts day and 12,500 watts night. That was denied by the FCC. 1280 WPKZ Fitchburg, Massachusetts, applies for a special temporary authority to operate with night pattern parameters at variance and will reduce night power as necessary. 1310 WDTW, Dearborn, Michigan, applies for U1 900 watts day and night from a temporary long wire antenna. 1310 WADB, Asbury Park, New Jersey, granted STA to reduce power at night during pattern work. 1410, KDKT, Beulah, North Dakota, Granite 500 watts day, 180 watts night from backup transmitter. 1470 WBCR Alcoa, Tennessee, applies for an STA to use U1, 1,000 watts day, 77 watts at night from a new site starting December 28th, as the station will lose its current site on January 1st. 1480 WEEO Shippensburg, Pennsylvania, applies for U1, 406 watts day and 9 watts night with a temporary antenna. 1570 KPIO Loveland, Colorado, was granted an STA for U1, 1 kilowatt day, 18 watts night. KPIO was knocked off the air in September's flooding, and partial repairs have been effected. 1590 WASB Brockport, New York, granted an STA for D3, 1,000 watts during work on night pattern. They expect to be off at night for around 8 weeks. Here's an AM Switch news item. The FCC has announced 22 auctions to be held in 2014 for new AM construction permits. The FCC has identified 22 sets of mutually exclusive applications for new stations that were filed in 2004 that it'll put up for auction on May 6, 2014. It's taking public comments on its planned procedures and the list of applications during December. Each of the original applicants must update its 2004 application prior to the auction. The minimum opening bid is set for each sale, ranging from $1,000 for several of the local channel auctions to $25,000 for the 1500 kilohertz California auction. No more than one CP will be granted in any one auction. The allocations that will be offered in this auction follow. The FCC has named each auction with a city and frequency, but sometimes the competing applications are in other places and on adjacent frequencies. All frequencies are the same as in the FCC name unless otherwise specified. 620 in Henderson, Nevada, or Boulder City, Nevada, for U4, 500 watts day and 520 watts night, or Henderson, Nevada, with U4, 500 watts day and 250 watts night. The application of WWWJ 1360 in Galax, Virginia, to move to 740 with U4, 2200 watts day, 1400 watts night, or Portsmouth, Virginia, or Windsor, Virginia, with U4, 20,000 watts day and 1200 at night. There is a 760 in Canyon, Texas, U4, 250 watts day and night, or Idaloo, Texas, with U2, 500 watts day and 250 watts night, or San Angelo, Texas, with U4, 1,000 watts day and 250 watts night on 750, or Shallow Water, Texas, with U4, 340 watts day and night. Enola, Pennsylvania is a suburb of Harrisburg, and there are two applications for 850. One is U4, 2,500 watts day and 2,000 night. The other is U4, 750 watts day and 350 watts night. Down in the Sunshine State, there are two competing applications to auction. 1090 in Micanopy, Florida, U4, 10,000 watts day and 250 watts night. Competing with Micanopy is the application of WHOO 1080 Kissimmee, Florida, which wants to move to Winter Park with U7, 27,000 watts day and 2,000 night, with critical hours power of 4,000 watts on 1080. Here's an interesting competing application, 1130 kilohertz in Eaton, Colorado, with U4, 1,000 watts day, 250 night, or Ravenna, Nebraska, with U7, 12,000 watts day, 600 night, and critical hours power of 3,000. If you like a rural location, there are competing applications on 1200 in Anchorage, Alaska, for U1, 10,000 watts day and night on 12,000 kilohertz, or Chugiak, Alaska, on 1210 with U1, 50,000 watts day and 30,000 night. Also competing applications on 1220 in Kuna, Idaho, with U2, 50,000 watts day and 5,000 night, as well as Middleton, Idaho, on 1230 with U1, 25,000 watts day, 250 watts night. I wonder if that 25,000 watts is a typo. I sure hope so. 1340 has two competing applications in Altura, Sam, California, and Lakeview, Oregon, both requesting U1, 250 watts day and night. on 1370. There's a virtual catfight. Applications include Cimarron Hills, Colorado, with U4, 1,000 watts day and 500 watts night. Colorado Springs, Colorado, with U4, 50,000 watts day and 250 night. Plus another Colorado Springs application for U4, 300 watts day and night. Bunkerville, Nevada, for U1, 5,000 watts day and 220 night. Henderson, Nevada, for U4, 2,500 watts day and 400 night. And a second app for Henderson, U4, 350 day, 292 night. And finally, Las Vegas, New Mexico, U2, 1,000 watts day and 250 watts night. This will be an interesting auction. In Arizona, there are applications for 1,400 for Kachina Village, Arizona, with U1, 1,000 watts day and night, as well as Prescott Valley, Arizona, with U1, 170 watts day and night. Two southern states take up the battle for the airwaves. Waynesboro, Georgia, wants a station with U1, 1 kilowatt day and night. And Barnwell, South Carolina, wants a station with U2, 260 watts day and 253 watts night, both on 1410. Also on 1410, Adrian, Michigan, asks for U2, 500 watts day, 250 night, while Lebanon, Tennessee, asks for U4, 250 watts day and night. Two applications for 1450, Montoursville, Pennsylvania, both for U1, 1,000 watts day and night. 1470 has one application for Coalinga, California, with U4, 250 watts day and night, and Huron, California, with U4, 1,200 watts day and 400 at night. Two competing applications for 1490 in Bozeman, Montana, one with U1, 1,000 watts day and night, the other with U1, 250 watts day and night. Also on 1490, two competing applications in Lovelock, Nevada, both asking for U1, 1,000 watts day and night. And yet another competing set of applications for 1490 in Bend, Oregon, with U1, 250 watts day and night, and Deschutes River Woods, Oregon, U1, 1,000 watts day and night. In Culver City, California, there are competing applications for 1,500 kilohertz. One application is for U4, 50,000 watts day, 4,300 watts night. The other is for U4, 25,000 watts day and 1,000 watts night. Here's a catfight starting with 1540 in Enterprise, Nevada, for U4, 30,000 watts day and 400 watts night. Las Vegas, Nevada, wants 1510 with U1, 250 watts day and night. Spring Valley, Nevada, wants 1510 with U4, 4,531 watts day and 453 at night. And here's an oddity, an application for Whitney, Nevada, to move WABV 1590 Abbeville, South Carolina, to 1550 in Nevada with U2, 1,900 watts day and 250 watts night. Down in Tim Hendel country, there are three applications for 1,600 starting in Huntsville with U1, 250 watts day and night. Warner Robins, Georgia, with U2, 1,000 watts day and 250 watts night and critical hours. And Charlottesville, Virginia, with U2, 5,000 watts day and 400 watts night. Finally, 1,700 in Muncie, New York, Ramapo, New York, and an application for WRCR 1300 Spring Valley, New York, to move to 1700. Stony Point Town, New York, wants 1700, as does Town of Havistraw, New York. Each of these applications specify U1, 10,000 watts day and 1,000 watts night, which is standard for an X-band station. It's a fair bet that at this late date, some of these applicants won't update their 2004 applications and will get tossed out on those grounds. We'll see over the next year how many of these CPs will be granted and then how many get built. By the way, the final proposal for the AM revitalization plan was published in the Federal Register on November 20th. Public comments can be filed no later than January 21st and reply comments by February 18th. If you'd like to comment, it's very easy to do so. Contact Fred Bobe at the address at the start of the show. Your comments don't need to be technical. They just need to be coherent and achievable. Here's Fred with some more info.
Thanks, Dave. Like Dave said, what the Federal Communications Commission is looking for are solutions to problems. They're not necessarily looking for you to vent about your local radio station, a disc jockey, or the fact that they don't play Tony Bennett music. What they're looking for are solutions which will help save AM radio. And I'll give you a couple for instances. One person has commented that they think that all the radio stations which are currently having interference at night should be able to double their power. Now, let's think about that. I think there's a precedent for this with the power increases given to the local stations several decades ago. Have you ever listened to 1230, 1240, 1340, 1400, 1450, or 1490 at night? And that jumbled mess, that's what happens when you just increase power. Another petitioner has stated that they think that AM stereo should be mandatory. Is that going to help? For my part, I focused on the interference issue that many radio stations face from devices such as televisions, LED signs. The proliferation of noise in the AM band is really a subject unto its own and something which has caused a lot of problems. I mean, when I can't get a 1,000-watt radio station here in my own town because a traffic sign blocks out the signal, there's something wrong with that. So I focused on the interference as well as the receiver quality, stating that there should be a minimum standard for the quality of receivers. Now, that's just my thoughts, but you should formulate your own thoughts and put them in a letter to the Federal Communications Commission, and I'll help you in any way I can with the filing. It does not need to be a big, long, verbose statement. It could be just a simple paragraph, and that's all that's needed. But to get your comments into the Federal Communications Commission, or if AM radio goes away and you haven't commented, don't say we didn't warn you. Dave?
Thanks, Fred. And one last item from Canada. Comes word that the backers of the now-expired CP for KJLI 700 Calgary, Alberta, have not given up on the project. They have some more land in the Black Diamond area they hope will be more suitable for a site for a four-tower AM array. Prior proposed sites ran into local opposition. To make the station real, they'll need to go back and begin the CP application process all over again. That's our long AM switch and the first one of 2014. Happy New Year. I'm Dave Alpert, and I hope you'll become a part of the DXAS AM switch by sending your news and information to Fred. We'll see you again in 30 days. But now, time for Mark Durenberger with the Bandscan column.
National Radio Club.
Hi, David. Thank you. And Happy New Year to you all. To kick off our 2014 get-togethers here on the Bandscan, let's, in response to some requests, take a look at some frequencies outside our usual medium wave broadcast band. In particular, today we're going to visit the long waves, and we'll investigate the tropical band. Some of you are quite familiar with what's out there. For the rest of us, we'll hopefully learn a few things and maybe come up with some new targets for DXing. First, what U.S. listeners might find on long wave, the band immediately below the broadcast band. And for this information, we are indebted to DXing.com. I'm going to read from the pages on their website. Long wave refers to all frequencies below the lower end of the AM broadcasting band at 540 kilohertz. The lower limit of what frequencies constitute radio is not precisely defined, but 5 kilohertz is a widely accepted starting point for the radio spectrum, even though it's in the middle of the audio spectrum. For many years, radio hobbyists ignored long wave because most commonly available communications receivers didn't tune much below 530 kilohertz. However, most new receivers today tune down to at least 150 kilohertz, and long wave DXing is enjoying new popularity. One big problem when tuning long wave is electrical noise from power lines, electrical devices, motors, and so forth. Long wave is far more susceptible to such noise than higher frequencies, and you might hear only a loud buzz when you tune across long wave from your location. Also, static crashes from thunderstorms can be severe, especially in summer. To combat noise, many long wave DXers use an indoor loop antenna that allows rejection of nearby electrical noise sources. Other DXers use special phasing units to reduce noise level, not unlike the medium wave captures. Reception distance on long wave is similar to that on the AM broadcast band, as are reception patterns. Greater range is possible when the signal is reaching you over a water path, as is often the case in coastal regions. At night, reception of stations from hundreds or even thousands of miles away is possible on the long waves. Night reception on long wave is better in winter than in summer, and the equinoxes often give the best propagation. Unlike the shortwave frequencies above 1700 kHz, the longwave spectrum is allocated on a more ad hoc basis, with different users and services frequently sharing the same frequency range. Here is a general description of the world below 540 kHz. First, below 155 kHz, signals there don't propagate very well via the ionosphere. The absorption is too great even at night during winter. These signals can travel for thousands of miles via ground wave, but high transmitter powers are required. Signals at very low frequencies, about 50 kHz and lower, can penetrate seawater very well. As a result, these frequencies are used by military forces of the major powers, especially for communications with submarines. The U.S. Navy's Omega navigation system is found on 12, 10.2, 13.6 kHz. The Russian Navy operates a similar system on 15.62 kHz. The U.S. Air Force has a frequency shift keying-based communications system on 29.5 and 37.2 kHz. This system was established to provide a backup in case nuclear explosions rendered the ionosphere useless for propagation. From 150 to 175 kHz in the United States, this range is used by the U.S. Air Force's Ground Wave Emergency Network called GWEN, a packet-based network to provide communications during a nuclear war. Transmitters are kept continuously operational here on a standby basis, and it's easy to hear GWEN's loud, raspy signal bursts. From 155 to 281 kHz, this is another AM broadcasting band in Europe and parts of Asia. In Europe, there are numerous high-powered stations of a megawatt or more. These stations capable of covering an entire European nation like France or Germany with reliable signals around the clock. Although ionospheric propagation is not good at these frequencies, the high powers used mean that many of these broadcasters can be heard along the Atlantic seaboard during the fall and winter. Best reception is usually from local sunset to about 0600 UTC. A few long-wave stations in Asiatic Russia can be heard on the Pacific coast beginning an hour or so before local sunrise. 160 to 190 kHz. In the U.S., this range is open to unlicensed experimental transmissions. Transmitter power restricted to 1 watt, and the maximum antenna length, including feed line, can be no more than 50 feet. Any mode can be used. Some of these loafers, as they're known, unlicensed stations, have been heard several hundreds of miles away under favorable conditions. 200 to 430 kHz. This range is used mainly by navigation beacons, which continually repeat their call signs in Morse code. They're also known as NDBs. Call signs do not follow the international allocations given elsewhere. Instead, the call signs usually give an idea of the location of the beacon. For example, beacon FT on 365 kHz is located at Fort Worth, Texas. 430 to 500 kHz. This long wave range is used for two-way Morse code communications between ships at sea and shore stations. Shore stations use three-letter call signs, while ship stations' call signs consist of four letters. All call signs in this band are from international allocations. The number of stations you can hear in this range is rapidly declining due to a shift in maritime communications to satellites and short wave frequencies. After February 1999, radio operators skilled in Morse code were no longer required on ships sailing in international waters. 500 kHz. This was an international ship calling and distress frequency for maritime communications in Morse code from way back. It's no longer used, and after February 1999, ship and shore stations were no longer required to monitor this frequency for calls. Now the frequencies from 501 to 504 kHz are available to amateur radio operators for Morse code and for CW low-speed operation. 500 to 540 kilohertz. This segment is populated by miscellaneous beacons and stations. Perhaps the most interesting frequency here is 518, used for transmission of maritime safety and navigation information via frequency shift keying. This system is known as Navtex and includes weather bulletins as well as notices of missing and overdue vessels. 530, as we know, is used in the United States and Canada for low-powered road and traffic information broadcasts. And, of course, there are some broadcast stations in Canada and Cuba on 530. A good source of information about long-wave reception techniques, stations currently being heard, and experimental stations currently being heard is the Long Wave Club of America, LWCA. And that information came to us courtesy of the website dxing.com. Next, we'll take a look inside the tropical band. This interesting range of frequencies is very propagation dependent and, like much of shortwave, requires some finesse and luck in finding a path open to these interesting stations. Now we're reading an edited version of a posting by Don Moore in the December 1998 Monitoring Times. Don writes, "To most people, the phrase tropical bands brings a pretty clear picture to mind, a bunch of shirtless guys playing calypso music. But to experienced shortwave DXers, those two little words express the most challenging and enjoyable part of the radio hobby. The phrase kindles memories of a DXer's best catches and favorite QSLs, of exotic music, and of early morning listening sessions. For many DXers, the tropical bands are what this hobby is all about, and if you haven't DXed the tropical bands yet, it's time to join the fun. According to the rules, there are three distinct tropical bands, regulated that is, 2300 to 2495, 3200 to 3400, and 4750 to 5060 kHz. Longstanding international agreements have set aside these frequency for broadcasting stations located between the tropics of Capricorn and Cancer. Most, but not all, countries strictly adhere to these location guidelines. The most common exception is out-of-band broadcasting, where stations use adjacent frequencies allocated to other types of radio services. For example, there are several dozen tropical band stations in the 5200 to 5700 kHz range. In some countries, such as Vietnam and Indonesia, these are official government stations. In others, Peru and Bolivia especially, private broadcasters in remote areas simply ignore the regulations, and the government does not have the manpower, funding, or interest to stop them. Thus, for all purposes, the tropical bands may be thought of as anything between 2,000 and 5,900 kHz. Furthermore, there are many smaller stations through 7,500 kHz that can just as well be considered tropical band broadcasters. The second exception to the regulations is that not all tropical band stations are in the tropics. For decades, China and Russia have had numerous stations in the tropical bands. One old Soviet tropical band station was actually located in Murmansk, north of the Arctic Circle. More recently, some U.S.-based shortwave broadcasters have used loopholes to get FCC permission to broadcast in or just outside the tropical bands. So we conclude tropical band stations are not necessarily tropical. The key word for tropical band reception is darkness. These lower shortwave frequencies only propagate long distances when most or all of the reception path is in darkness. For the listener, that means from about 2 hours before local sunset to about 2 hours after local sunrise. The station heard must also be in or near darkness. Right now in midwinter, there are less hours of daylight than at any time of year, which means more hours when tropical band DX can be heard. Nicely enough, static levels are also at their lowest in midwinter, which means we're at the beginning of the best tropical band DX time of the year. Because of the need for darkness, there are particular time periods or windows each day to listen to tropical banders from different regions. Because Latin America is south of North America, It's the simplest. Anytime it's dark or near dark at your location, you can probably hear some Latin American tropical band stations. However, most stations sign off by 0400 UTC, and few sign-ons begin before 0900 UTC, so there isn't much to be heard in the middle of the night. There are two windows for hearing African stations. The first begins an hour or two before sunset at the DXer's North American location and lasts until about 2400 UTC, at which point almost all African stations have signed off for the night. Eastern Africans begin the sign-off parade about 2000 UTC. The farther west the listener is located, the shorter and later this window is. On the west coast, actually, there is no first window at all. The second window starts at 0300 UTC when the East Africans begin to come back on, and that one lasts until sunrise at the transmitter site. As morning moves across Africa from east to west, more stations sign on. They may be heard for an hour or so until their local dawn catches up with them. The last stations in West Africa fade out around 0700 to 0800 UTC, depending on the time of year. While this second window is open to all North America, signals are usually weaker as one moves toward the West Coast. The third main target area is East and South Asia and the Pacific, for which there is one main window in the morning. After darkness covers the West Coast, gradually moving across the Pacific, creating darkness reception paths as it goes, this target area opens up from Australia to Mongolia and from Pakistan to Vanuatu. So there's usually a lot of variation geographically and seasonally. But generally speaking, some part of that region is within the darkness path to North America between 0800 and 1500 Universal Time. Of course, because of the North American sunrise, East Coasters have the shortest window, ending about 1200 UTC, and West Coasters have the longest and strongest signals. During the winter months, however, East Coasters, and to a lesser extent Midwesterners, do get the benefit of a late afternoon window to parts of East and South Asia, generally around 2100 to 2200 UTC. Of course, nothing is quite that simple. Tropical band reception tends to be best during gray line enhancement. We'll skip the technical background, but the ionosphere gets extra excited during the gray line period when it's changing from light to dark or from dark to light. If either the listener or the station is at sunset or sunrise, with the change happening, reception is enhanced. If both the listener and the station are on the gray line at the same time, wow! However, between any two specific points, finding the target and the receiver on a gray line does not happen very often. The when and where of gray lining can be determined through software such as GeoClock, paper maps which DX clubs sell, or other tools such as the slide rule like DX Edge. Why do DXers go after the tropical bands? The biggest reason is the challenge, because most tropical band stations are broadcasting just for listeners in their own country. Transmitter powers are usually low. Few are over 10 kilowatts, many under 1 kilowatt. And unlike the big guys, few tropical band stations have antennas that maximize low-angle, distant propagation. Transmit antennas are usually designed for high-angle, relatively local coverage, or are haphazardly put up without any plan at all. The other reason to DX the tropical bands is to find out who can be heard. For a variety of reasons, the tropical bands are not the best place for long-distance propagation of radio signals. Now, that's not to say you can't hear distant stations on the tropical bands. Far from it. But if you're a major international broadcaster and you want to get a good, solid, consistent signal into your target area every day, the higher frequencies work better. That's one of the reasons there is so very little international broadcasting in the tropical bands. However, most of the world's countries do not have an international broadcasting voice with English programs for overseas listeners. Most do have some sort of domestic broadcasting on shortwave, however, and it's usually found in the tropical bands. It's impossible to log more than about 70 or 80 countries without DXing tropical band stations. With the tropical bands, many DXers have heard over 200 countries and over 1,000 stations. Finally, there is the programming, which is a lot different from international broadcasters. Because most tropical band stations broadcast locally to their own country, this is a great chance to hear real local radio from around the world. It may not always be professional, but it has an authentic quality that has disappeared from much of the homogenized U.S. radio dial. Of course, most broadcasts will be in a local language other than English. If you know a little Spanish or French, that usually can be of help. However, many things to be heard on the tropical bands transcend the language barrier. For example, there's nothing like the excitement of a Brazilian football game, soccer, to us. It's easy to feel the atmosphere even without knowing a word of Portuguese. And wait till you hear your first goal scored. Of course, music overcomes any language difference. And for good international music, the tropical bands can't be beat. We said that pretty much any fairly new receiver will tune the long wave and tropical bands, of course. The shortwave receivers will, most of them. Of course, a receiver is no better than its antenna. An outdoor wire antenna is a near must for tropical band DXing. Beverage antennas, several hundred feet of wire strung in a straight line about 8 feet above the ground, are DX Nirvana. But for most people, only practical on de-expeditions. However, small active antennas and indoor loops can be almost as good if they're located in a quiet environment. I continue to have very good results with my 20-year-old ferrite bar loop, which easily sits on the top of my desk. In-depth information about buying receivers and using specific antennas is beyond the scope of this article. But remember, while equipment is great, plopping down $1,000 for a fancy tabletop receiver doesn't make anyone a good tropical band DXer. An experienced DXer with a Sony 2010 will outhear a novice with a Drake R8 any day. So how can you become a good tropical band DXer? Learn the bands. That's why an experienced DXer with minimum equipment will outhear a novice with the best. The experienced DXer knows what's usual and what's unusual. When tuning the bands, he or she will stop for a few seconds with each station found. Based on the frequency, language, programming, signal quality, and time of day, they'll know who most stations are. If something's different, that'll stick out as well. Perhaps there's a new or rare station on a usually empty frequency. Maybe Spanish or Guatemalan music is heard on a frequency that had been occupied by a Brazilian broadcaster. Maybe a usually weak but regular African station booms in, indicating enhanced conditions to that region and a chance to go after less common stations. There is no magic to successful tropical band DXing. The longer one pursues the hobby, the more experience is gained and the better the DXer becomes. So isn't it time to begin your own tropical band memories of best catches, favorite QSLs, and early morning listening sessions? And who knows, you might even hear some calypso music. To close, here are my best bet tropical band stations, 25 of the best heard countries heard in North America, 2325 Australia, 3290 Namibia, 4725 Myanmar, 4753 Indonesia, 4755 Brazil, 4770 Nigeria, 4777 Gabon, 4835 Guatemala, 4835 Mali, 4890 New Guinea, 4910 Zambia, 4915 Peru, 4915 Ghana, 4920 Ecuador, 4926 Bolivia, 4930 Honduras, 4980 Venezuela, 4990 India. The Solomon Islands heard on 5020. Cuba is on 5025, 5030 Costa Rica, 5047 Togo, 5077 Colombia, 5125 China, and 5500 Ethiopia. And that information is from a posting by Don Moore in the December 1998 Monitoring Times. So there we are for January 2014. Probably more information than you needed or wanted, but maybe something you heard will stimulate you to looking at new parts of the dial. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service. We'll see you in 30 days. Again, Happy New Year and a great 2014 to you. And good listening, DXers.
While many Americans and DX radio enthusiasts sit on their hands, apathetic to commenting to the government's plans to kill off radio, it seems that the United Kingdom has some rebels ready to fight when it comes to losing their analog radios and being forced to change to digital. Like the United States, the UK wants to kill off analog radio, implement digital, or as they call it, DAB. Many AM stations have already been switched off, and now it's FM's turn to go silent. Some radio listeners are fighting to keep analog, a fight which may pay off if enough voices are heard. This story comes from the BBC and is titled Radio Rebels Fight Against Digital. David Salito reports.
Richard College is a man who loves his radios, and he's a total convert to digital radio.
I was just wondering if you had somebody in mind.
Fairness question time.
What's so good?
It's the clarity.
It will be hard work getting it out.
There's no interference.
Worth it.
Yes, I'm sure it's not.
Thank you. Can you hear any interference?
Good afternoon, Carol Linton from Wavefleet.
Let's have a listen to FM.
If I go to FM, yeah, this is the FM tuner. You can hear the interference. That's not clear at all.
The era of twiddling the dial, hunting amongst the hiss for our favourite stations on FM and AM, is coming to an end. Digital switchover will eventually shift most big stations off FM for good.
However, some people are very unhappy at this idea. Indeed, inside this shed is something of a growing resistance movement. Good grief.
Rob Mannion's shed is a little shrine to radio. For 25 years, he edited Practical Wireless magazine. And he has a problem with digital radio.
It's a crucial way to know whether you're delivering the producer.
It's dreadful, isn't it? It's absolutely appalling. It's breaking up, and sometimes it will break up altogether.
Surely they'll be able to fix that.
The most important thing is
I don't think so. Not unless they insist that everyone plugs their set into a fixed antenna, like your television is.
He fears digital will always have black spots. He doesn't want to lose FM.
You are leading a resistance movement.
I will try. I think I'm leading a resistance. I'm leading the Common Sense Brigade.
This is Studio A. This is where the shows are broadcast from.
And he's not alone. This is Spire FM in Salisbury, run by Kerry Herford-Jones. And he doesn't want to shift to digital.
If the opportunity was there, would cost us nine times more than we currently pay to be on AM.
Put some numbers on that. What are you talking about?
You're talking anything at the moment up to £90,000 to £100,000 to be on digital. That's a year. We simply couldn't afford to do that.
Of course, while Spire may not like digital, much of the rest of the industry does. And men like Richard, would he miss FM?
So could I get you to go back to the old FM radio?
No, I wouldn't want to go back to that.
You
can't entice me. No, I'll stick with my DAB radio.
But for Rob, in his shed, with his mast, he doesn't want to take any risks. The loss of FM will be the loss of a reliable old friend. David Salito, BBC News, Bournemouth.
Next week, the British government will set out its plans to switch off FM transmitters in favor of digital radio signals. But many people are still reliant on analog radios. An estimated 95% of cars lack DAB equipment, which isn't stopping the switch. Perhaps the rebels will win against the FM switch-off. So maybe the Brits have a stomach for a fight, while Americans might be ready to sit back and watch their radios slowly fade away. In Dallas, Texas, I'm Wally Warbrow for the DX Audio Service.
One of the legends of rock and roll radio has passed away. Super jock Larry Lujack has died at the age of 73. He suffered from esophageal cancer and had been in hospice in Santa Fe, Mexico, says Robert Fetter of the Chicago Trib. What can you say about a talent who inspired so many people to enter the radio business? Generations of Midwesterners can talk about his animal stories with Tommy Edwards on Chicago's WLS 890 and his skeptical take on the day's news. Lujack was born in Iowa in 1940 as Larry Lee Blankenberg and started out at Boise Market KCID in Caldwell in 1958. He moved up to the markets through Spokane,
San Bernardino, Seattle, Boston, and Chicago. In Chicago, he worked at both Top 40 radio stations, 890 WLS and AM 1000 WCFL. By 1975, Lou Jack was famous enough to write a book titled Super Jock, The Loud, Frantic, Nonstop World of a Rock Radio DJ. He retired for the first time in 1987, following the death of his son John. Larry relocated to New Mexico and came back on the air in Chicago twice by remote broadcast, at then WUBT 103.5 and WRLL 1690. Uncle Lair was inducted into the Chicago-based National Radio Hall of Fame in 2004 and the NAB Radio Hall of Fame in 2008, where he showed his iconic wit was still very much with him. Lou Jack's silences could be powerful, and one of his widely copied characteristics during a bit was audibly shuffling papers. Videographer and radio historian Art Volo tells Now magazine that the last video I have of him was at the 2008 WLS Rewind, and highlights of that broadcast can be found on YouTube. Larry is survived by his wife Judith, two sons, a daughter, and a stepson. His widow tells the Sun-Times that he didn't want a memorial service, and that his body is being donated to the University of New Mexico's Medical Center for research. Lou Jack's death leaves a lot of radio pros thinking about their younger days and mortality. Rest in peace, Uncle Lair.
Fake pirate radio DJ exposed live on air. This article appeared on UK Radio Today on December 4th, 2013. A man who claimed to be a 1960s pirate radio disc jockey has been challenged as a fake live on BBC Radio. Mark Dean appeared on The Late Show, on BBC Radio Lancashire, and BBC Radio Manchester, taking calls from listeners and talking about his career. In a live interview broadcast over 90 minutes on Thursday, he told presenter Alison Butterworth that he'd spent 2 years aboard Radio Caroline North, staying with the station until it closed down. It later emerged that his only connection with the station was that he drove a van carrying equipment for the Radio Caroline Roadshow, a mobile disco run by fans in the 1970s. During the interview, the supposed DJ said the ship was called the Mi Amigo, the name of sister station Radio Caroline South. He worked with Kenny Everett, who worked for rival pirate Radio London, had never met senior presenter Bob Stewart, who was a fixture on the station, and he stayed on air till it closed in 1967. It shut down in 1968, having defied the Marine Offenses Act, which outlawed the pirates. The alarm was raised by BBC local radio's political correspondent Paul Rowley, who was listening to the program. "Everything he said was either hazy or wrong," said Paul, who had listened to Caroline North as a schoolboy and compiled a radio documentary about the station, The Other Radio Caroline, which won silver in the Frank Gillard Awards for Original Journalism in 2009. "So I emailed Alison Butterworth during the show, and she put me on air. I told Mark Dean that no one of his name had ever worked on Radio Caroline. I asked him pretty simple questions about the history of the station, and he didn't seem to know the answers. I put it to him that he'd never broadcast on the ship, and he insisted he had. I cross-examined him live on air, and he continued to get basic facts wrong. So I challenged him to admit he was making it up. He maintained he was genuine, so I put it to him bluntly that he was a phony and a fake. Eventually, someone emerged who knew Mark Dean, although that wasn't his name. And he wasn't 71 as he claimed. He was 57, which meant he would have been 9 years old when he started broadcasting. One of the organizers of the Radio Caroline Roadshow contacted Facebook saying that Mark had driven a van and moved equipment for them in the late 70s. He is a good-hearted guy who did lots of charity work, but unfortunately a total dreamer. I intend to contact him and complain bitterly. The Late Show has subsequently made several attempts to speak to him without success. On Monday, the program repeated the exchange and made an on-air appeal for him to confess. Former Caroline South DJ Tom Edwards contacted the show. "I squirmed when I listened to the program because the man was obviously lying," said Tom, who was on Radio 1 and 2, in a broadcasting career lasting several decades. "First, I was quite angry, but now I'm quite sad that someone would want to lie about being a disc jockey on Radio Caroline." He was never on Caroline North, and he has upset a lot of friends of mine who we call anoraks, who know more about pirate radio than I can remember, and I was actually there. Allison Butterworth admits she had her suspicions after Mark had been booked to appear after he recently took part in a phone-in on 60s music when he claimed to have been a pirate at the time. "What is astonishing is that in 25 years of live broadcasting, I have never met someone who was so adamant that what they said was true when it wasn't. He didn't flinch. He didn't blush when he was confronted." Psychologist Phil Tyson, who heard the exchange, told the program that Mark probably believes he was on Caroline. "It's a tragedy, really. My heart's going out to him. Why does somebody need to do that? Is it in order to get a little bit of attention or notoriety? We all lie to ourselves a little bit. It's perfectly normal." Some people develop a bubble of mistruth, which they then move into and inhabit. And if that's not tallying with reality, it causes them some level of distress. This is a guy who has had many years of peddling his mistruths and dealing with other people, challenging them, so it doesn't surprise me that he's got a really thick skin. And that article was "Fake Pirate Radio DJ Exposed Live on Air," which appeared on UK Radio Today on December 4th, 2013. For the DX Audio Service, I'm Chris Gay.
Let's jump over to part two of the DX Audio Service, and we'll do that with a jingle in honor of Uncle Lair.
WLA, coming on strong with music.